Today on Against the Grain, the protest spurred by police killings of African Americans and other people of color has finally brought the punitive nature of the U.S. state into national view. Writer Joanne Wippiewski argues that for at least the past half century, we've been witnessing a particularly punishing turn by the state, often fueled by moral panics about sex. She joins me to make sense of the present in light of struggles over crime and punishment, wrongdoing, and restorative justice, including in Me Too. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In 2017, a movement swept the U.S. and well beyond, sparked by multiple accusations of rape by film producer Harvey Weinstein. Everywhere, women started to call out men by name, often prominent men, over sexual harassment and assault. Me Too was embraced by many feminists as bringing to the fore finally the abuse of power by men over women, especially in the workplace. Longtime radical writer and feminist Joanne Wippiewski, however, was concerned with the part of the movement that unwittingly seemed to embrace the patriarchal punitive state, as she explores, among other themes, in her new book, What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too, Essays on Sex, Authority, and the Mess of Life. She's also the co-editor of Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence. Let's start with the moment we're living through, Joanne, of mass protests against police brutality sparked by the killing of George Floyd. You've written a great deal on state power and punishment. How do you understand this moment, taking, as you can do, the long historical view?
Well, I understand this moment in the context of an ever-increasing and expanding accommodation to violence and punishment in this society. And that's not to say that, you know, there was some golden time. There wasn't. I think the United States has a bloody, brutal history from the beginning. But I've been concerned, especially over the last 50 years, and that's something that sort of is a theme in my book, whereby serial panics around sex, which typically involve narratives of good and evil, monsters and victims, have got a lot of people, including progressives, very used to the language of the punitive state, very used to the language of the presumption of guilt, of trial by media, of locking him up, of changing the laws, making the laws harder, of vengeance as a social good. And so I think, not to in any way suggest that all of this is responsible for the killer policeman who horrifyingly sat on the neck of George Floyd for 9 minutes while he died. But I think it's not enough ever to say, isn't that horrible? Or to say, isn't that person awful? Isn't that policeman awful? Aren't those five policemen awful? I think what's important and what I explore in various ways in the book is how we have got used to that punitive state, how we have got used to that carceral state, that idea that punishment, that violence, that getting the bad man in one way or another is really what unifies us. There's a great phrase that the anthropologist Roger Lancaster uses, and he calls it a poisoned solidarity. And it means a way in which we identify by means of who we don't like, who we want to get, who we don't care about, who's the bad man. And I think those are really violent arguments. I think those are really violent ways of constructing a society. And I think when you look at the institutions of a society, the police force, etc., you know, it's not enough just to say it's racism or it's white supremacy. It is those things. But I think you also have to really think about how we all, in one way or another, kind of have these reflexes, because the culture raises us to be violent. After all, it raises us to think that way. It raises us to think about punishment, and it's all, I think, a kind of politics of fear that's structured our time for, you know, a very long time.
I'd like to turn to talk about Me Too. In 2017, Me Too exploded on the scene, was championed by many feminists as laying bare the patriarchal oppression of women by men. And yet there were other feminists, yourself included, who found many aspects of Me Too unsettling. Tell us why.
Well, I think, you know, the language, the lists, the insouciance toward false allegations, people would say, you know, so a few people are accused unfairly. So that may be just what we need to, you know, to get toward justice, to end the patriarchy. The sort of idea of trial by media, you know, the idea that suspicion equals guilt, accusation equals guilt, the jumping to conclusions, the appeals to belief, none of these things are in line with what we consider to be legal justice. And I know legal justice is not, you know, is not perfect, and it's often very limited, and it's often unfair and not just at all. But there are certain things like presumption of innocence. There are certain things like due process that were really piff-poffed, you know, back then. You know, people actually said that these aren't things we need to deal with. A writer in the Washington Post, Anna Marie Cox, wrote, "The courts aren't where our national conversation is taking place, so let's not dither about the dangers of proclaiming guilt or innocence." So, you know, dithering about guilt or innocence is pretty interesting to me. Her choice of words was pretty interesting, because what have we been doing but dithering while the police state has grown? You know, it's now the case, or it was when I wrote this story, that 50% of black men are arrested by age 23. 40% of white men are arrested by age 23. So in the book, I say nothing says patriarchy like the police state. And I think that's true. I mean, I think if you're dithering over, if you say, let's not dither over guilt or innocence, that's an assumption that's made in a very cavalier fashion, and it ignores the way culture and social attitudes bleed into the law, and I'd say into law enforcement. And so, you know, it's so easy. And again, this is not to in any way minimize the danger of the police. I live in New York City. The New York City police are very scary and very dangerous. But I think it's too simple to say, oh, the police are violent, the police decide guilt or innocence, they shoot people just like that. You know, they execute a man because they think he had a counterfeit $20 bill, or they shoot a child, Tamir Rice, several years ago, because they thought his water gun was a real gun. And, you know, there's all kinds of assumptions that we make about how we're endangered and how we secure safety. And those notions increasingly are not, you know, they're not about solidarity, they're not about love, they're not about a new way of being, they're not progressive, they're not radical, they're not left, by my way of seeing. So I think Me Too was really, yes, necessary for the people who wanted to have a hearing, but I think it's also really really critical to recognize the difference between hashtag Me Too and Me Too as it was begun by Tarana Burke. Now, Tarana Burke began Me Too as a sort of language for people who had none, for young women and girls who had no way of expressing that that they'd been hurt, that they'd been violated, that they'd been scared. And she was working with young women and girls of color, and she used that term for people. I mean, she encouraged her students to use those words as sort of a placeholder. You know, they weren't ready to say what happened to them. They weren't ready to you know, come out with the whole thing. But they wanted to signal that they had something to say. And so it was a way of getting a hearing. And getting a hearing is fundamental to justice. You know, George Floyd did not get a hearing. Trayvon Martin did not get a hearing. Many people do not get hearings. But hashtag Me Too kind of turned that on its head. And it said, ah, now we will be judge and jury. We will name and shame everyone who we feel has ever harmed us, and we are asking you all simply to believe. So a kind of faith-based justice, a kind of faith-based law that is highly selective and that has no need no evidence, need no pondering, need no, certainly no response from the accused. The accused is supposed to shut up and disappear. And I don't think that that represents any advance for women. I don't think women are safer because some women call for stronger punishments, because they call for the end of statutes of limitations in sex-related cases. I don't think they're safer because of a movement that seems kind of giddy for vengeance. I don't think vengeance is a social good. I don't think it's something to be celebrated.
Do you think that some of what brought out these aspects of Me Too had to do with a feminism or a notion of the oppression of women that really didn't have any sort of conception of the connection between patriarchy and the state and the repressive function of the state?
Well, it's a really white form of feminism. I would say yes to your question, and I would say that, you know, when people at that time were saying this is a great advance for feminism, I think we all need to ask, well, what kind of feminism? Because the feminism that's the most compelling to me, that always has been the most compelling to me, is that which was articulated by the Combahee River Collective, late 70s, African-American anti-capitalist feminists who wanted to see a kind of connection between every realm of oppression, and said, you know, you can't deal with anything in a vacuum. You can't deal with anything by itself. And of course, they were women who were keenly aware of the state's role in Black men's lives. So a lot of the women in that collective, if not all of them, were lesbians. And but they had certainly an interest in economic domination, in racial domination, in misogyny, in international affairs, you know, in the U.S., kind of rape and pillage of countries all over the world. They saw, you know, they saw feminism as a live way of being human in the world, fully human in the world. They were very interested in sexual freedom. They were very interested in human freedom and economic freedom and targeting and opposing all forms of oppression, which would of course involve the state. Now, I don't think white feminists typically saw the state as a danger, or the apparatus of the state as a danger. And I think that's a mistake.
I'm speaking with writer and editor Joanne Wipiewski. She is the author of What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. One of the things that Me Too did, at least partially, was to discuss sexual harassment in the workplace, or so many of the cases were to do with situations at work. What do you feel was missing in the examination of dynamics of power in the workplace as they were framed by much of Me Too?
There was a very simplistic notion that sexual harassment was the worst possible thing anyone could experience. And again, I always have to say, I'm not supporting sexual harassment. But I think if you look at the working day and the workplace and the way the workplace functions and the way the boss functions and the way the boss functions, by the way, whether he is a man or she is a woman, is often to certainly to control, but often to humiliate the worker. And that humiliation can take many forms, and sexual harassment is one of them. It can also be a kind of regular denigration. It can be a failure to accept your ideas. It can be letting you know in a thousand ways that you don't count, that you don't matter, that you're not special, that you are no one. And then that's just the psychic side of it. The actual physical side of it is the actual brutality of the working day, the actual brutality of so much work, the lack of basic safety measures, the lack of concern for workers' health and minds, the notion, for instance, you know, farm worker women really jumped on the Me Too slogan when it came out. They're very, very savvy because they wanted, you know, they wanted their issues to be put on the agenda, on the political agenda, where typically they're completely ignored. And so the actresses and the other women who were, you know, in the fore of Me Too, they embraced farm workers in California. But there was something so preciously naive about so much of the, you know, feminist, new feminist, whatever you want to call them, Me Too response to that cry of the farm workers, because the assumption often articulated actually was that, well, if we get rid of sexual harassment in the fields, these women will be just fine and they'll be able to rise to their full potential. And, you know, I was just thinking, I mean, I've written a lot about labor and class and union politics, and I've done a lot of work on the history of the United Farm Workers. There's a great book called Trampling Out the Vintage by Frank Bardicke that I edited, which is about the history of the UFW, and it's also about the history of work, and it describes work in the fields, for instance, very, very granularly. And, you know, for anyone to think that one's problems will be over, for instance, if you are a strawberry picker, if only you're not subjected to sexual harassment and violence, that is very naive indeed. And, you know, it's a weird situation to be in where you have to keep saying, I'm not saying there's nothing wrong with sexual violence. There's nothing wrong with rape. I'm not saying that. You know, when you talk about crime and in any other context, you know, you don't have to constantly say, this is not to say I approve of murder. But one constantly feels the need to like assert that, of course, sexual harassment is wrong and sexual violence is wrong. So let's just posit that violence is wrong. Violence comes in multiple forms. And as I say at one point in the book, violence is a subject that doesn't wear out, but its most insidious forms don't require weapons. And so I think when you get to economic violence, racial violence, the violence of language, the violence of everyday life, that's a heady brew, you know, and it can't, it's not that it shouldn't be disentangled, really. It shouldn't be that the workplace is a site we worry about it just for this for sexual harassment, or let feminists worry about it for sexual harassment, and let labor unions worry about it for say wage and hour claims. I mean, you know, the fact is that if you have a kind of solidarity politics and if you have a radical analysis, then you know you can't see these things independently. You have to see, you know, you have to see the economy and the structures of the economy, and you have to see the culture and the structures of the culture as they connect.
Indeed, and to the point that there are multiple levels that we need to respond to these questions on. I mean, as you've just said, a lot of these things are structural and interconnected. So trying to solve them in one spot isn't going to solve them everywhere unless we think about taking on those larger structures and systems. And yet at the same time, people who have suffered from sexual assault are going to be demanding some kind of remedy. And I wanted to ask you, how should
Absolutely.
we, and bearing in mind what you're saying about the punitive state, are there other ways that we could think about justice in the here and now, given that we're still stuck in this society, whether we like it or not? And what would a term that we hear a lot elsewhere, but not around Me Too, where would restorative justice fall in all of this?
Well, there's a wonderful book that's also just out from Verso by Judith Levine and Erica Miners, and it's called The Feminist and the Sex Offender, and that's a very straightforward title, and it deals quite a lot with the question of restorative justice and how, in trying to make a change and in trying to realize you know, the dream of a better life, how do we deal with harm? And that's very important, how we deal with harm, because people are hurt all the time in this society. And I think we've pretty much proved as a society that that targeting people, that locking them up, that making prisons bigger and bigger, that making the laws harsher and harsher, sentences harsher and harsher, the creating registries of sex offenders and labeling whole populations of people less than human, none of that makes anyone safer. So we've, I think, proved that, and so I think the ground is laid for experiments of restorative justice and just what that would look like. And I would suggest people pick up their book, The Feminist and the Sex Offender, because it speaks much more to that question than I could. I think obviously there need to be alternatives, and I think it's interesting that the experiments in restorative justice are also coming out of, you know, black and brown communities, urban communities, mainly, you know, in cities, and also in native communities and in Hawaii, where people really have not seen the state as an ally, and where people are certainly acutely aware of harm and communal harm as a reality, but don't want to add to that. By destroying families, by destroying communities, by sending more people to prison. So I think that's not something that we heard in Me Too. You know, what we heard in Me Too was a kind of shrill cry, and I understand why people are angry, and you know, they don't want to hear another thing. But Me Too was called a political movement, and I think if it's a political movement in fact, then it's important as citizens of the biggest prison state in the world and the biggest exporter of violence in the world, I think it's really important that we consider how even our arguments against violence can be colonized by it. I don't think that's a puny idea or a puny demand or request. I think everything we do contributes, everything we do in public life, every movement, every action contributes to the world that we want in some ways. But I guess I think the Hollywood actresses and the people who informed me too at the beginning and Time's Up really were not the most oppressed people in society, and so might have really given some thought to their own position in that society.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking today with Joanne Wypijewski. Her last name is spelled Wypijewski, and she's the author of What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too, Essays on Sex, Authority, and the Massive Life. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Among her many books, she is the co-editor of Killing Trayvons. So I want to ask you about the media, not just in Me Too, but in the promulgation of the kind of politics of fear that you argue in your book have been defining of our era and have led to panic upon panic. How do you see the role that the media plays in making us feel fearful and demanding punishment?
Well, I think the most obvious way is, and you can look at any tabloid of any story that reaches that 24/7 news cycle, where the monster is always on the front page and the title of the story is some pun on, you know, his monstrosity. And if you go back to, so the first piece in my book is called The Secret Sharer, and it's about an HIV panic that took place in 1997, 98. In upstate New York, in a town called Jamestown, not far from Buffalo, where I grew up. And there was a young man, he was 20 years old, he was black, he was a drug dealer, he was from Brooklyn. He was very charismatic, he was violent, he was hungry in so many ways. He went up to Jamestown, he was immediately popular with young women. At some point he was told he had HIV. He was in denial, or he didn't believe it, or he thought it was we don't really exactly know what he thought, but anyway, he continued to have sex with young women. No one was particularly worried about HIV. No one was worried about condoms. No one practiced safe sex particularly, once in a while, maybe, so-so. It didn't happen between heterosexuals, was the idea. And that was an idea shared by many heterosexuals of all social classes. And, you know, when it was learned that he had HIV and that some of these young women had turned out to be positive, the state decided to put his face on a kind of wanted style poster and splashed it all over upstate New York saying, you know, have you had sex with this man? And there was his image and, you know, the dark man with the short braids and the quote pleasing personality. And if you did have sex with him or with anyone who had sex with him, you should rush right down to a clinic, and don't worry, your confidentiality will be completely honored, even though his was not. And he was immediately called a lethal Lothario, the devil himself, you know, he all kinds of terms like this. And the New York tabloid press loved it. The you know, CNN, the television press loved it, the proper press, New York Times, etc. Everybody loved it. That man was put in jail for 12 years for having sex when he was 19 or 20 with a girl who was in at parties, who was 14 or so. And he pled guilty. He went to jail for 12 years. And after that, he was put in a mental institution forever by the state as a sexually dangerous person. Now, there are 6,400 people in this country who are indefinitely imprisoned after having completed their sentences in mental institutions as, quote, sexually dangerous people, people who are locked away, forgotten about, no due process, no rights, forever, because of what we fear they might do. So this is the society we have. This is reality, you know? We have about 900,000 people on sex offender registries. Those people can't live as human beings. In many places, they can't rent an apartment. They can't have a job. They can't go to school. They live under bridges. They live in parking lots. They live in their cars. If they have children, they can't take them to the playground. They can't take them to school. They can't go and watch their school pageants, say. If they are younger people living with their parents can't have pictures of their own grandchildren or baby pictures or anything around the house. They can't have alcohol, even if the crime didn't involve alcohol, even if the crime didn't involve children. The regimens of life, if you want to call it that, people call it social death. The regimens are so severe that people literally have no freedom, even if they're ostensibly free. So, you know, the rules and regulations are different in every state. The reporting requirements are different in every state. There are 400 at least homeless men in Chicago who've got together to try to help each other and to oppose a form of weekly registration. They had to do this even during the height of the COVID crisis. You know, I mean, the levels of horror in the society that we accept in order to be safe are quite astonishing. And there's no actual safety. There's an illusion of safety that this horrible circumstance sort of creates. And we never stop to ask, or rarely stop to ask, or very few people stop to ask, what is the cost of knowing? What is the cost of our knowing? Recently, there was a fellow in, just a couple weeks ago, in Nebraska who was shot. And he was a registered sex offender, or he was on the sex offense registry, because that's another mind thing, you know, that you forever are labeled as the worst thing you ever did. You can never be forgiven. You can never grow. You can never be human. You can never change. So anyway, this guy was on the sex offense registry, and he was found out, and he was murdered. And his daughter, whom he had violated, said, "Well, I'm glad he's dead. That's good, you know. I'm glad he's dead. I'm free." Now, okay, I understand why she's glad, and I understand why she feels free. But the media started writing columns, and there is actually a column, and I wish I had the citation for you, but somebody wrote, "Can murder be a social good? Question mark." So let's debate, you know, is there value in killing the awful man? And so, you know, I think the media runs on scandal. Sex sells, bleed leads, blood, if it bleeds, it leads. Those are very old, you know, those are very old tropes of the business. But they have done quite a job on conviction upon accusation. And those people who are demonized, who are made monsters, can never get justice.
I'm speaking with Joanne Wipiewski. She is the author of What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too, among many books. She writes for The Nation, where she was an editor for many years, journalist and author. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the kinds of situations you've been discussing, the criminalization of, I think his name was Nishon Williams,
yes,
the HIV positive man who was locked up, is, you argue in your book, just one part of a kind of moral panic that has been going on in the United States for 50 years. And that moral panic is a sex panic. I wonder if you could describe for us, what is a moral panic and what do you date its beginning to?
I mean, it goes back very early, and if anyone has watched or could put themselves through watching Birth of a Nation, they would see that that is a perfect symbol, cultural symbol of the making of a moral panic, where the white women are all endangered by newly freed black people in America, black men in America, and have to be lynched, killed, put down by force by the Klan. So that's you know, a sort of item that Hollywood has given us, the really wonderful example of our culture at work, and our fears sort of reflected in with no uncertain terms.
And you argue in the book that in the United States, panics around sex are also very often, anyway, panics around race.
Yes, of course they are. I mean, I don't think you can, I don't think you should see, you can, I don't see how people can talk about sex crime and not instantly think of lynching. I mean, I really don't, because lynching is, even though more people were lynched because of things other than the rape of a white woman, the rape of a white woman became the symbolic crime for which the black man had to pay, and had to pay in the most gruesome way, and the most gruesome and public way. And so, you know, the awfulness of that, apart from the absolutely almost indescribable savagery of the white killers, was the fact that the accusation alone was enough, and justice was impossible. And I say that because if accusation alone is enough to kill someone, to punish someone, to put someone away, then nothing has to be proved. So whether it's true, whether it's not true, it doesn't matter. So now we all believe that all those white women who ever said I was raped or violated in any way by a black man were lying. And we can understand why we say they were all lying, because the sentence was death. And it was death whether they were telling the truth or whether they were lying. And now we're sensitized to the idea that this was a horrible thing. But the crime against, you know, justice there, certainly the crime against humanity is incalculable. The crime against justice is that it made it a matter of indifference whether somebody actually committed a crime or not, because they were going to be punished regardless. They were going to be punished on the basis of the accusation, on the basis of who made the accusation, a white person. And women were not safer, because women had no recourse with their own men. If their own men raped them, white men raped white women, it didn't matter. If black men raped black women, it didn't matter. If white men raped black women, it didn't matter. So anyway, the point is that white panic, sex panic, moral panic, the fear of the monster, the fear that, you know, we have to be protected and we have to be protected by violent force, goes back, you know, to the beginning of the country. But, you know, just within the last several decades, you know, there's a kind of a series of moral panics that have been put to very particular political use. And, you know, from the 1950s, when there was a panic over sexual psychopaths, which was another term for homosexuals, it's frequently forgotten that homosexuals were blacklisted, were hounded, were surveilled, were entrapped as much during the Red Scare as communists, if not more. There have been rages since the 60s against, you know, sex education, gay liberation, gay sex, gay teachers, gay threats to the family, strangers going to trap your kids, take your kids, crime, porn, satanic ritual abuse in daycare centers, sexual abuse dug up from repressed memory, AIDS predators, super predators, internet predators, sex offenders, as I said, is a separate category of human beings, pedophile priests, epidemic campus rape. So all of these things have been on each other's heels, I mean, almost consistently since the 60s. Now, the early ones, you know, anyone who watched during lockdown, Mrs. America on FX Hulu, will have had a really interesting lesson in how the fight against the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have, you know, just said that women have equal rights in this country under the Constitution. We don't have it now. That fight, you know, it brought in religious fanatics, it brought in white supremacists, it brought in every kind of slimy political actor for the sake, really, not so much to overthrow the amendment or even to end abortion or to stop homosexuals, although those were all part of the agenda. The real agenda was political power. The real agenda was to create a political base. And this is what a lot of people who talk about, you know, in on the left, you talk about class politics and class, it's not identity. A lot of people don't understand just how crucial identity has been to organizing the right, to organizing a base of support for things like, you know, invasions all over the world and the expansion of the military and the redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top. You know, Reagan's election was built on the movement against abortion, against homosexuals, against the ERA. Those were all the foot soldiers of the Reagan Revolution. And the Reagan Revolution, you know, Reagan really didn't care that much about homosexuals. For God's sakes, he was in Hollywood. And Ron didn't really care one way or the other, but Ron wanted power, and Ron knew it. And he got it. And then when AIDS swept, he looked the other way for years as tens of thousands of gay men died of AIDS. So, you know, this is real. Sex is not some kind of sidelong thing. It's not something that's just, oh, you know, it's about harassment, or it's about porn, or it's about what we like to do in the bedroom, or it's what we don't like to do in the bedroom, or, you know, it's about our fantasies. It's about all those things. It's about human life most deeply. It's about the mess of life, you know, it's implicate the mess of life, but it is very, very specifically also a weapon that has been used to organize fear and to organize a political base for very different things and very successfully, so that you have things like the 1994 crime bill. And you have Joe Biden now trying to figure out how in the heck is he going to walk back all the years, all the statements he made about how he's tough on crime and he's going to, you know, he's going to be the one to, you know, he's like the sheriff. And then he can say, well, I've got the Violence Against Women Act in the 1994 crime bill. And isn't that wonderful? The Violence Against Women's Act did virtually nothing for prevention, virtually nothing for women's safety, but quite a lot to expand punishment, to expand penalties, to expand the prison system. And the fact that it was part of the 1994 crime bill meant that it was a tool for co-opting women and progressives to support that bill. Now, a lot of people didn't, but many, many people did. And of course, it passed. And we now have the biggest prison population in the world.
Joanne, I want to end by asking you about how we could think about sex and sexual politics differently, how we could break away from seeing things through the lens of moral panic, which you've been describing has really predominated, and not just for the right, for liberals and even in some cases the left. And I wanted to ask you, how might we think about a different kind of politics, given that when you were listing off the things that have fueled panics, some of them, like the satanic daycare stuff, was, you know, completely unfounded and very much fanned by the media. And then you have other ones like the clerical abuse scandals that have a basis in fact. But how can we address any of those things and shape a politics that takes sex and sexual politics seriously while sidestepping the pitfalls that have befallen so much of American politics?
Well, first I want to say that the book is not an action agenda. So the book is really an exploration of stories and currents. And so I don't present myself as somebody who has, you know, the answers, but I do think that human experience is a messy thing. And so the subtitle of the book, Essays on Sex, Authority, and the Mess of Life, is really almost the title of the book. How, as children, for instance, we are able to say what we want, how we're able to experience pleasure, how we're able to experience our senses, whether we'll ever get any sexual education that deals with, as a young woman in Jamestown said to me so many years ago, the emotional side. You know, how it feels, like how I feel about myself, how I feel about someone else. Whether we look at people in the complexity that their lives are. We say, oh, violence is something we have to end in communities. And it is, absolutely. And the kids in communities are scared. But what strengthens kids, you know, what allows kids to really be sensitive, to really feel their skin, to really feel love, you know, and to be allowed to express themselves in a way that gives them joy. How are they not regimented? How are they not trained for obedience and authority so that they can never stand up to authority? Now, and sometimes, of course, you can't stand up to anything, but we want people to be able to stand up for themselves. We want people to be able to express what they want and what they don't want. And that starts quite early, and it has to be embedded, I think, in this thing, this mess of life. You know, politics exists in the mess of life. Sex certainly does. And sexual politics has to, too, if it's going to make any sense at all. It has to deal with people's weaknesses and their mistakes and their desires. And it has to have some appreciation for the human person. You know, the last chapter in my book is an appreciation of James Baldwin. And
who's been in the minds of many people, talks, I think, during these days.
Yeah. But Baldwin is sometimes simplified too much. And Baldwin was a genius, I think, and just one of my favorite writers, because Baldwin said, you know, it's not enough. It's not enough to just talk about racism or oligarchy or capitalism. All those things are real. All those things are repressive. All those things bind us. But we have to ask each one of ourselves, you know, why we do the things we do, why we think the things we do. And he made a point in one of his essays saying that it's so important to separate yourself from the habits of thought that reinforce and sustain the habits of power. And I think that leaves so much to think about. I think that that rests with us the task of imagining a way of living better, a way of being better, a way of imagining a different way of life. Because it is in human experience that we see part of the route for change. You know, how we think about things is as important as this horrible thing that's coursing over the TV. Because getting back to the beginning of this discussion, how many names could we set up? This book I did with my fellow Kevin Alexander Gray and Jeffrey Sinclair, Killing Trayvons, it's a catalog of Trayvons, of George Floyds. We can name their names, you know, as people say. But obviously, there needs to be a revolution of the mind. And I don't think that's a small thing, but I think it's an essential thing.
Joanne, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Joanne Wipiewski. She is the author of What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Me Too, Essays on Sex, Authority, and the Mess of Life. That's published by Verso. And you can find a link on Against the Grain to that book. She's a writer and editor, author of many books. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.